headlines, a deepening row over fishing waters. Britain says it reserves the right to respond to France's seizure of a British trawler one day after London summoned the French envoy. Sudanese anti-coup protesters press ahead with a civil disobedience campaign. Security forces have killed at least 8 people since the Monday coup. And the number of coronavirus-related deaths in Iran keeps declining as the country speeds up its nationwide vaccination drive. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. A dispute worsening between France and the UK over post-Brexit fishing rights. The UK, angry over France's seizure of a British trawler in French waters, says it reserves the right to respond in a proportionate way. Environment Secretary George Eustace says it's always possible for Britain to increase its required measures on French vessels. On Wednesday, France detained one British fishing boat and issued warning to another in its waters. Paris said the detained boat lacked proper license and its captain will face trial next August. Paris did so in retaliation for London denying fishing licenses to EU boats, including the French ones, operating in British waters. Paris has threatened more retaliatory measures starting from next week if talks don't progress. Britain has called threats unjustified and summoned the French ambassador for explanations. James Tweedy is a journalist and commentator who joins us. So who's right here? Is France in the right or the UK?
This is an issue which is, let's say, very symbolic in French politics. France is, I think, making a mountain out of a molehill, and its threats are very disproportionate. I mean, what we're talking about here is, the other day, it was only about 2 days ago, it was 35 boats, and now it seems to have gone up to 55. We're talking about small fishing boats applying for rights to fish in the territorial waters around Jersey, one of the Channel Islands. These are not strictly part of the UK, they're pound dependencies, but they're basically British territory, close to the northern French coast. And there are part of the agreement that was made between Britain and the EU when we left the EU was that boats that had traditionally fished in those waters would be allowed to, during this kind of 5-year sunset clause period, after we've left the block. And the British government is saying that, okay, there's been 55 applications and there's no record of these boats ever fishing there before. Okay. All right. But other than that, Britain has granted licenses to about 1,700 boats from the EU, which is 98% of the ones that have applied, and 750 of those, almost half of those, are French boats. So the French have done all right around this, you know, out of this, because you know, when we were in the EU, we were part of something called the Common Fisheries Policy. So all the fishing boats from all the 27 nations at the time could fish in each other's waters. 28, I think, could fish in each other's waters as much as they want. So boats from Greece or Cyprus could sail up the Mediterranean around and into British waters and catch fish in our exclusive economic zone, right? Now, in Iran, I think you know about exclusive economic zones because you've got one that extends out into the Persian Gulf, its end is where that of Qatar and Bahrain and so on begin, and you have valuable mineral resources underneath the seabed there. So, okay, Britain's economic zone, exclusive economic zone, is very large because Britain is an island with little archipelagos of islands attached to it. And, the French fishing vessels were making a lot of, you know, they were doing a good business with this, and, okay, now it's over, the party's over. Okay. But, you know, for the next 5 years, they can continue to fish, and then things will be reviewed. But, okay, some livelihoods are being lost. Now, in the overall scheme of the French economy, it's not very big. In the overall scheme of the European economy, the EU's economy, it's almost nothing, because what's really important overall, let's say, is things like exports of manufactured goods. largely from Germany, but also from France. They make a lot of cars. But, you know, so France is now talking tough. It's saying it's going to stop British boats from landing in French ports. It's going to try and snarl up trade between Britain and the EU, and it's essentially unilaterally saying it's going to tear up the trade and cooperation agreement which we signed when we left the EU. And this is the thing that the EU has ironically been accusing Britain of doing with Northern Ireland, but seeking to invoke one of the Article 16 of that agreement. Okay. And also they're threatening to cut off supplies of electricity to Jersey, because Jersey buys a lot of electricity from France, which generates it from Utes, which it gets from its former colonies or its neo-colonies in Africa. It gets the uranium from there. And it also sells that energy to mainland Britain, saying, well, we're going to cut that off, and then we're going to have terrible energy crisis this Christmas, you know, this winter. So, you know, it's all a big thing, but it's all escalating very quickly. But whether they really want to jeopardize the trade and cooperation agreement is another question, and whether other countries in the EU, especially Germany, will want that to happen is questionable. And they might, you know, it's been said that the European Commission is supporting France, but when you look into it, it's the French appointee to the European Commission, who is predictably supporting his own country. So let's see how this one plays out.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, James Sweetie, journalist and commentator there from Plymouth.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Okay, moving on to Sudan. Anti-coup demonstrations shows no signs of abating there. Protesters are determined to press ahead with a campaign of civil disobedience against the military takeover. Capital Khartoum is bracing for major demonstrations on Saturday, following deadly clashes between security forces and protesters. Parliament and soldiers from the army have been deployed to Khartoum, as well as the twin cities of Khartoum North and Omdurman. The UN has called on the Sudanese military to show restraint.
I want to reaffirm my strong condemnation of the coup and the need to reestablish the transition system that was in place. And tomorrow there is a manifestation that is announced. I urge the military to show restraint and not to create any more victims.
Sudan had been ruled by a joint civilian-military council since August 2019. On Monday, the military led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan dissolved the power-sharing government and declared a state of emergency. Several top officials, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, were detained. Hamdok was later released under close guard. The country has been the scene of anti-coup rallies since the military takeover. At least 8 people have been killed and 170 others injured. International bodies have reacted to the coup. The U.S. Security Council has urged the military to restore the civilian-led government. The World Bank has halted financial aid to the African country. The African Union has also suspended Sudan's membership. Julius Maluto is a radio host and political analyst who joins us. We're looking at what has been announced to be a million-man march for tomorrow. What do you think is going to come out of that? Will it make a difference?
If I just stand on the ground of Sudan, just like a Sudanese citizen, I can sense the undercurrent of politics there, whereby a lot of people, Sudanese, are yearning for change, and that change means democratic rule. Remember, Sudan has been there. 17 coups have been there in the country, some successful, others not. But it's time since independence of Sudan. It's about time when I think people think they've had enough of military coups. They just don't want it anymore. And I can see tomorrow a lot of determination on the streets of Sudan by the protesters. We are seeing right now a lot of protesters who led the revolution, which was hijacked by the military. Before, of course, the discussions, agreement for transitional government happened, we are seeing them coming back. Iconic figures, even ladies who are leading that revolution, are already, some of them are back, and definitely there will be change, because I see a situation whereby Sudanese are not relenting. They'll never stop until they get civilian leadership, democratic rule, because that's what they deserve. Otherwise, you know, this military rule is suffocating and is not good for any country. And you know what? It's about time, because pressure, you ask the patient whether this is going to make a difference, because the protests are coming at the back of all these worldwide united stance. Africa Union, you know, kicking out Sudan out of the Africa Union, European Union, every other big power, US as well, totally not in agreement with them, and they are just boxed. They just need to back off, and they just need to go to drawing board. Allow this transitional government to have a chance, and allow Sudanese to have a democratic rule, which is what they've been yearning for so long.
Do you think, in any shape or form, you're having the General Burhan to act the way he has, in terms of him being steadfast about this transition not to take place right now, because he is being backed by, the, as they call it, the Troika, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt?
He's still a very lonely man, and yes, with any form of support, is bound to be a bit an extremist in some ways. For example, when you see him coming around and, you know, recalling all the ambassadors who supported the idea that the coup was a wrong thing to do, you definitely, he's already on the defensive. You're already seeing him, what he's trying to do. And therefore, if you were to find a situation whereby he's got a backing of any country or any force, or even within the Arab League, probably then you will have some more energy to go on. But, you know, when it comes to practical governance of a country, it's not easy when your country has been so isolated, so boxed, like, okay, fine, even help from the international community not coming, and all these other things. Definitely, whether he likes it or not, you will feel the impact of lack of support from the Western countries, from the United Nations, from African Union. You definitely understand those are powers to reckon with. So this support he's enjoying right now, it's not his support, but I don't think his support that would be sustainable. But probably then, of course, even these other countries that may be sympathetic to his regime, they may realize that democracy is better than dictatorship, and Sudan has the right for once just to enjoy democratic rule, which they have never, you know, all these years, over 30 years under Omar Bashir, military takeover, before that, 17 coups. You know, if I'm a Sudanese on the ground, I would be definitely fed up. I would never want to see military trying to govern. See, the essence of military is to defend the country from external attack, and it's not just. And even if there was problems within the political arrangement democratically, they are there as a buffer to protect the country, and as while it's taking shape, when new governance is forming, that's where they are there for. But to begin to participate in politics is a vicious circle that will never end. Military takeovers always begets military takeovers most of the time, which is a catastrophe. And that's what Sudanese want to see ending.
Thank you for that. Julius Maluta, radio host and political analyst from London. Many thanks. A new all-time high for COVID-19 deaths in Russia. This while the country is struggling to bend the curve using lockdown measures. The National Coronavirus Task Force has reported 1,163 new COVID deaths over the past day. It's the 10th consecutive day that Russia is reporting over 1,000 fatalities. Some 39,000 new daily cases have also been confirmed in the same period, pushing the country's total caseload to more than 8.4 million. The spike has prompted the government to impose a nationwide workplace shutdown in the first week of November. Neighboring Ukraine, health authorities logged a record daily high of nearly 27,000 new cases and a further 648 deaths. The country has so far confirmed over 2.2 million cases and nearly 67,000 deaths. the number of COVID-19-related deaths in Iran, meanwhile, is decreasing as the vaccination process is accelerating across the country. According to the health ministry records on Friday, 123 people lost their lives in the past day. This brings the total number of coronavirus deaths to nearly 126,000. Some 10,000 people have also tested positive in the same period. Health officials say more than 85 million doses of the COVID vaccine have been administered, and the process is accelerating. Authorities have warned that ignoring health protocols could lead to another peak of the disease. Tehran says issues pertaining to its nuclear program have already been settled in a multilateral agreement signed in 2015. The focus of the upcoming talks must now be the removal of anti-Iran sanctions.
Nuclear negotiations bore fruit and were finalized within the framework of an agreement between Iran and the opposite side. We practically don't have a nuclear issue to address today, but because of the U.S. violations of its commitments, the agreement, and the UN Security Council resolution, and also the failure of EU countries to implement the provisions of the agreement between Iran and the P5+1, we are facing illegal and tyrannical sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Fakhri Khani made the remarks during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Ryabkov in Moscow. The two sides agreed that new talks will only succeed if they lead to the removal of sanctions and the full implementation of commitments by all parties to the deal. Bagheri Khani said Iran, Russia, and China share similar views on regional and international matters, especially the nuclear deal. He added that the European signatories to the agreement must also live up to the agreement and strive toward the removal of sanctions. Fresh talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal are due to begin before the end of November. The United States has imposed a fresh round of sanctions on Iran as part of its unilateral measures against the country. The latest bans target several companies and individuals connected to Iran's drone program. The U.S. Treasury claims that Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has supplied lethal UAVs to resistance movements in Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen. It claims the drones have been used to attack U.S. forces and international shipping in the Persian Gulf region. Iran has not responded to the claims yet, but it has previously rejected similar allegations. Tehran insists its advances in the military and defense sectors are not meant for aggressive purposes and only serve as a deterrent. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. 4 days from a 2019 panel discussion of the U.S. Council for National Policy revealed that former U.S. President Donald Trump's tax cuts for the rich were sparked by personal conversations. We'll prepare for you an article written by Jason Wilson. The piece is titled, How a Secretive Conservative Group Influenced Trump's Tax Cuts. Documents and recordings obtained by The Guardian shed new light on a powerful and secretive right-wing network and the influence it was able to exert on former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration and policies favoring the super-rich. The recordings include speeches given to the Council for National Policy, or CNP, by conservative media stars including Dennis Prager, emerging Republican power players such as Charlie Kirk, and close economic advisors to Donald Trump. Some of the previously published recordings appear to no longer be publicly available. The Guardian's independently sourced recordings offer an insight into how conservative economic thinkers from bodies representing the interests of some of the richest individuals in the country were able to exert influence on the supposed populist Donald Trump. In particular, a panel discussion at the Council for National Policy, CNP's February 2019 meeting, suggests that Donald Trump decided one of his most far-reaching economic policies on very limited evidence, on the basis of a personal conversation. The panel involved Bill Walton, president of the Council for National Policy, CNP. The Washington Times columnist and former member of the Cayman Islands Monetary Authority, Richard Rahn. Jonathan Williams, chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. And Stephen Moore, a one-time Donald Trump nominee for the Federal Reserve Board, whose nomination was withdrawn following revelations that he had failed to pay his ex-wife hundreds of thousands of dollars in alimony. The panelists offered a favorable assessment of the Trump administration's economic performance, but also used the platform to claim credit for pushing the Trump administration in the direction of radical free market policies. Stephen Moore claimed that he, together with Larry Kudlow, Donald Trump's director of the National Economic Council from 2018, had persuaded the then-president Donald Trump to offer unprecedented corporate tax cuts. He described a meeting with Trump where they argued that the United States' corporate tax rate relative to those among certain Asian and European competitors was effectively a penalty on U.S. companies, stating, "Look, you know, we're at 40%, they are 20%. This is a big problem." Stephen Moore said that they explained these tax differences using charts because Donald Trump likes to look at pictures he doesn't like to read. According to Stephen Moore, Trump looked at this and he said, "No, I don't want to do that. Instead, proposing not 20%, I want 15%. With the number coming back to an effective 20% rate only after Senate negotiations. Donald Trump's tax cuts slashed effective corporate tax rates in half, while providing other measures benefiting wealthy corporations. According to business reporters and economists, the cuts have been blamed for widening inequality in America and worsening deficits, with a large amount of the savings going to stock buybacks. The Congressional Research Service pointed out that any positive effects like the wage or gross domestic product growth were transient and had petered out by the end of the quarter in which the cuts were put into effect. This reveals the power of the Council for National Policy, the CNP, a little-known body whose members are deeply secretive about their meetings. The CNP attendees' access to this picture of the inner workings of the Trump administration and the players who helped set its course is the result of adherence to a strict code of silence. In introducing the panel, the Council for National Policy Conference Director, Mary Margaret Hathaway, enjoined participants to secrecy, reminding them to not record any speaker remarks. Hathaway said, "CNP meetings are off-limit to the press, so please be aware of who you're talking to." She added, "Don't grant any interviews if you can run into a reporter asking questions about the event. Please let a member of the Council for National Policy staff or leadership team know." Despite her warnings, the organization itself made the recordings obtained by The Guardian and uploaded them on their website in a manner that made them accessible to any internet user. Other recordings obtained by The Guardian include talks at 2018 and 2019 meetings by senior Republicans, including Senator Tom Cotton and the U.S. Congressman Steve Scalise. The former governors, including Scott Walker and Sam Brownback. The Council for National Policy, CNP, was founded in 1981 by influential Christian right activists, including Tim LaHaye, Howard Phillips, Paul Weyrich, who were also involved in founding and leading the Moral Majority. Initially, they were seeking to maximize their influence on the new Ronald Reagan administration. In the subsequent years, the Council for National Policy, CNP, meetings played host to presidential aspirants like George W. Bush in 1999 and Mitt Romney in 2007, and sitting presidents including Donald Trump in 2020. Furthermore, on the other hand, the Trump administration and its chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, have been charged with a sweeping and audacious illegal payment scheme of tax-related crimes, marking the first criminal charges against the former president's company following a years-long investigation by the New York prosecutors. Weisselberg, who had worked for the Trump family for nearly 50 years, surrendered to the authorities at the Manhattan Criminal Courthouse recently and was charged by the Manhattan District Attorney with failing to properly report company perks, including rent-free apartments, school fees, and cars, in the latest stage of an escalating battle between New York prosecutors and the former president. The 15-count indictment against Alan Weisselberg and the Trump Organization charged them with a scheme to defraud, grand larceny, criminal tax fraud, and falsifying business records. According to prosecutors, the Trump Organization paid employees rent, utility bills, garage fees, school expenses, and other living expenses without properly declaring them so that they could and did pay federal, state, and local taxes in amounts that were significantly less than the amounts that should have been paid. Kerry Dunn, general counsel for the Manhattan District Attorney, said the 15-year-long arrangement was a sweeping and audacious illegal payment scheme. According to prosecutors, and Weisselberg was one of the largest individual beneficiaries of the scheme. The system was orchestrated by the most senior executives at the Trump Organization. According to the prosecutors, Alan Weisselberg received $1.7 million in illegal payments, including rent, bills, and garage fees for his Manhattan apartment and tuition expenses for Weisselberg's family members. Weisselberg and a lawyer for the Trump Organization pleaded not guilty. We'll be right back.
people.
U.S. aging nuclear program.
America's nuclear reactors are getting old. The oldest one opened in 1969, and the average age of all the reactors in the country is nearly 40 years old, and this age is considered too old for sensitive nuclear reactors. Most reactors which operated then are still active today.
It was the first step in a nuclear nightmare. As far as we know, at this hour, no worse than that. But a government official said that a breakdown in an atomic power plant in Pennsylvania today is probably the worst nuclear reactor accident to date. There was no apparent serious contamination of workers, but a nuclear safety group said that radiation inside the plant is at 8 times the deadly level, so strong that after passing through a 3-foot-thick concrete wall, it can be measured a mile away.
Hello and welcome to We the People, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll study aging nuclear plants and nuclear arsenals in the United States. Serious nuclear weapon incident could also be just around the corner, and the Pentagon even has its own phrase for it, Broken Arrow. There have officially now been 33 nuclear arrows in the history of the United States so far, a number which could be far greater in reality. So what are the risks facing the nuclear sector, and should you be worried? Stay with us.
10 years ago, the Fukushima meltdown triggered a flurry of coverage, raising alarms within the U.S. about the decrepit reactors and how they may function in the face of a dysfunction in the reactors. Most notably, are they safe enough? More than ever before, the nuclear technology seems to be on the verge of slipping out of the U.S. government's control.
The catastrophic aspect of nuclear energy has been there from the get-go. Project Trinity potentially came close to a catastrophe in 1945 in the desert of New Mexico, when a lightning storm occurred as a bomb was sitting on top of a tall steel tower. Our first guest today is John LaForge, co-director of Nuke Watch. Welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, John, what are some of the general dangers in having nukes this old, this outdated in America?
Well, they're very similar to the dangers of brand new reactors. They're all confronting living things with the very same dangers. They emit liquid and gaseous radioactivity on a regular basis. They're allowed to do this by permitting. Governments permit nuclear reactors to emit radioactive gases, krypton, xenon, and tritium, daily in order to regulate the temperature, the heat, and the pressure inside these units.
Thank you for joining us, Mr. John LaForge.
After World War II, the U.S. nuclear powers shifted mostly from nuclear warfare to the Cold War and ultimately towards energy production. President Eisenhower championed the cause and attended the opening of the first plant near Shipping Point, Pennsylvania.
Adding radioactive materials to the environment means that it ends up in the air, in the water, in the soil, ultimately in the food chain. Other dangers include as you mentioned, with old reactors, you have the problem of parts wearing out, equipment being badly or intermittently or inadequately inspected and replaced if need be. And so the failure rate of parts and equipment in reactors increases as they age. The rate of failures goes up.
Many more power plants followed in the 1960s, although most of them were for experimental or training purposes and shut down within a few years' time. A slew of new plants, however, popped up in the late 1960s, as well as the 1970s and 1980s. We're now joined by nuclear scientist Behrad Nachai to get his perspective on this issue. Thank you for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, if you could, please tell us, what are the impacts of outdated nuclear plants on an environment already reeling from the impacts of climate change?
Every problem that you have in nuclear power, or you have had with the nuclear power, was the direct result of human error. If we follow the procedures and we follow what has been dictated to in the operation will go very smoothly. the nuclear power plant is built with many, many, many layers of safety and precaution. And because of that, it is very tolerant. Yet, the nuclear power plants that are operating today in the United States or in majority of the countries of the world are of the older generation, where we were still learning how to build, what to build, and how to operate.
Thank you, Dr. Nahe, for joining us on the program.
One of the most concerning aspects of the U.S. nuclear energy is the infrastructure, the wiring and computers in the launch control centers that still rely on 8-inch floppy disks. After all, creating complex technological systems is one thing, and managing them another.
Now, with all the potential dangers that they carry, nuclear power plants supply about 20% of electricity for the U.S. power grid, although almost all of them were built decades back. Looking at the plants today makes one think of a vintage movie set. Do you think old reactors in the United States are doomed to end in failure? What scenarios could you imagine about the fate of those reactors?
Reactor meltdowns caused by earthquakes, tsunamis, other weather events like hurricanes, tornadoes, and quakes that threaten to shut off the cooling of these machines, resulting in overheating, meltdown, and then the broad and disastrous dispersal of highly radioactive material, cesium-137, iodine-131, strontium-90, and other highly radioactive materials that cause so much cancer and other immune disorders.
Nuclear plants not only produce radioactive waste, but they are also vulnerable to a nuclear meltdown. A simple backup power failure could simply prevent water pumping used to cool the radioactive fuel rods, leading to a disaster. The fuel could heat up rapidly, and since these reactors operate at high pressure, there can be explosion from all this excess heat. The fuel itself is toxic and has to be stored underground for thousands of years. One can only extract about 4% of the energy out of the uranium, and the 96% that is left behind is waste.
The nuclear power plants that are operating today in the United States or in majority of the countries of the world are of the older generation, where we were still learning how to build, what to build, and how to operate. All these nuclear power plants are maintained, revitalized, changed continuously at every 2 years that they go refueled. So the plant that was built 30 years ago can get a license to run another 30 years.
Many experts and activists believe that Washington urgently needs to transform its regulatory framework, its culture, and its infrastructure related to nuclear operations. According to some estimates, the U.S. will spend about $188 billion over the 2021 to 2030 period to modernize nuclear weapons and delivery systems.
Since we cannot have a destructive testing of the nuclear power plant, we rely quite a bit on the operating experience for different parts of the plant, and IAEA should spearhead that to get into cooperation with the countries to have a safe nuclear power plant rather than try to politicize it.
The U.S. is set to spend some $175 billion toward modernizing its strategic nuclear triad and $13 billion to modernize its tactical nuclear weapons and delivery systems. So where do politicians, both liberals and conservatives, stand when it comes to closing the country's old nuclear power plants?
In the U.S., the pro-nuclear lobby is very, very rich and very powerful. So at the moment, the Congress is considering a bill that would spend $50 billion to prop up and give financial support to old reactors instead of shutting them down. The other thing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has been doing is increasing the allowed lifespan of nuclear reactors. Every one in the United States was built to last 40 years. The NRC has uniformly and repeatedly given 20-year license extensions to reactor operators, so all over the country.
The U.S. old tech in the nuclear sector means that there is always the possibility for an unexpected accidental launching, firing, detonating, theft, or loss. So far, some 8 U.S. nuclear weapons have been lost and, shockingly, never recovered.
Inadequate maintenance and inspections. You have cutbacks because of economic problems with the cost of electricity and the reactor operators cutting back on inspections. You have corrosion of particular parts because of the corrosive materials inside these aging units that also weaken and degrade the parts. Ultimately, you have a possibility of loss of offsite power, as happened in Louisiana just recently as a result of a hurricane. Offsite power to the Waterford reactor in Louisiana was cut off, so that meant, and this was after the power went out altogether, that electricity to recirculate the cooling water was halted.
The United States military misplaced at least 8 nuclear weapons permanently during the Cold War. The so-called strain nukes are said to have a combined explosive force 2,200 times the bomb the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima at the end of World War II.
Nuclear power programs in all these countries were initiated in order to provide plutonium for nuclear weapons. It was just a production source of a source of plutonium, because the operating of a nuclear reactor using enriched uranium for fuel produces plutonium. The consequence of bombarding this uranium inside a reactor with neutrons creates plutonium inside the fuel rods. Now, the fuel rods are then removed and replaced with fresh ones after a time, and the used highly radioactive fuel rods can be treated chemically in these giant factories, chemically treated to extract the plutonium for weapons.
The U.S. has nearly 5,000 nuclear warheads with silos in North Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana. Now, this is while the country is short of skillful staff tasked with safeguarding the deadliest objects ever known to man. Dangerous mix of aging nuclear plants, industry cost-cutting, and reduced safety oversight could come at a great cost not only for Americans, but for all of humanity.
The problems with the environment have to do with people and the animals that live nearby. Many times, studies have repeatedly shown that the effects of these emissions on populations near reactors is an increase in cancer and leukemia, especially in young people.
The U.S. government needs to immediately address deficiencies in its oversight of nuclear reactor safety. At a June 2019 meeting, Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner Jeff Barron elicited from the staff that the number of sudden reactor shutdowns saw a nearly 20% increase and rose from 39 in 2017 to 46 in 2018.
Problems with older reactors, as I mentioned, tend to increase as they age. And so the impact on the environment is multiple, many-fold. It involves the, as I mentioned, the emission of radioactive gases and liquids, the problems of maintenance and upkeep, and the environment around these nuclear reactors ends up to be more heavily contaminated with radioactive materials than areas that don't have active or operating reactors in them.
The U.S. has too many nuclear weapons and facilities, but appears incapable of taking care of them properly. The U.S. narrowly avoided a catastrophic disaster when two Mark 39 hydrogen bombs were accidentally dropped over Goldsboro, North Carolina on January 23, 1961.
Politicians are indebted to the nuclear lobby, which Professor Judith Pasternak showed spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year. Her study was published in 2010. With her students, she found that the companies that run reactors and the unions that support the workers in these plants spent $600 million lobbying between 2008 and just in 2 years, from 2008 and 2009, they spent that much money.
In the 1961 incident, a Boeing B-52 Stratofortress carrying 2 3-4 megaton Mark 39 nuclear bombs broke up in midair, dropping its nuclear payload in the process near Goldsboro, North Carolina. Bombs miraculously failed to explode, but there are still those who defend the nuclear sector as a source of clean energy, arguing that more nuclear plants should be built in America.
Eventually, the hope is that the United States, because of the pollution and because of the climate changes, will come around and build new reactors. The mentality toward nuclear power in the United States has been changing quite a bit during the recent years. And now, whether you are the left or the right, conservative or liberal, more and more are realizing that a main response to the problem and challenges of climate is the nuclear power plant. And it's more and more coming back in the fold, and the people's attitude to a nuclear power plant are changing as well, and more are accepting.
The U.S. nuclear power industry is facing major challenges. The nuclear reactor fleet is getting older as the sector faces other cheaper and safer sources of energy from the sun, the wind, as well as gas. More intensive monitoring and preventive maintenance are therefore required for them to operate safely.
The way the industry calls it safe and reliable and carbon-free, all these things are preposterously wrong, and they're demonstrably, provably wrong. We know from disasters at Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima that none of these reactors are safe. Because of power outages, sea level surges during horrific storms, that these reactors aren't reliable. And of course, the mining and milling of uranium, the production of fuel, the building of reactors that involves hundreds of millions of tons of cement can't be considered carbon-free for a minute.
After all, aging-related failures could result in catastrophes that even U.S. adversaries such as Russia and China would not want. What is the relation between the U.S. nuclear sector and its rivalry with other superpowers such as Russia?
In the nuclear power plant technology, there is no rivalry based on technology. The rivalry only comes based on each country's financial interest. There are around 440 nuclear power plants operating around the world. About 93 of those are operating in the United States, about 56 in France, about 50 in China, about 38 in Russia, and about 33 in Japan, and goes down the list. It really amounts to, number one, technical capability of designing, building, and operating of the nuclear power plant, and two, whether financial part justifies. Russia has a lot of capability to build more, but because of the oil and gas that they have, they only build nuclear power plants when they need it.
Since old times, U.S. nuclear plants have been playing an important role in U.S. energy production, but they remain old, dangerous, and unsafe. There is not enough supervision on these plants, and many U.S. activists believe they're like ticking time bombs, particularly with little inspection from nuclear watchdogs such as the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Inability to convey the information about the safety of the new nuclear power plant. Other countries are far ahead of the United States. For example, China is ahead. France is thinking about the new reactors. United Kingdom is studying for the new reactors, and many other countries are actively studying and building new reactors.
Some of the plants in the U.S. are currently working beyond the license granted to them by the U.S. government itself. Who are the victims suffering from repercussions of old nuclear plants, and what role should nuclear watchdogs such as the IAEA play?
None of the older reactors, whether United States or any other country cause any damage. If the management follow the rules, follow the procedures for the operating of those plants, IAEA has two important, very important roles that often due to bending of due to political will is does not perform sanction. Number one is to provide help to every country around the world that wants to use peaceful nuclear power plant. IAEA is not doing that effectively enough. It should get more into that. Number two, it should provide a very bank of information about the operation of nuclear power plants around the world.
The U.S. ability to protect their facilities from terrorist attacks are also on decline, which could potentially expose them to rogue element, raising prospects of fuel meltdowns and releases of radiation to the environment. Only in the year 2018, more than 100 security violations were officially reported, a figure that sounds alarming to the public.
We also need to educate the lawmakers, parliamentarians, the politicians, and other government officials about these hazards. We need to work locally with city and municipal council members, especially in areas where they have operating nuclear reactors or nuclear facilities like a reprocessing plant, for example, or a fuel fabrication site, or potential uranium mining. We need to connect with other movements as well, like campaigns against gun violence, climate change, campaigns for racial justice and indigenous people's rights, diversity in political life. All these groups or campaigns are relevant to challenging the status quo here. We need to disrupt also the dominant narrative about nuclear power.
Now, many experts highlight the increasingly significant necessity for an appropriate level of oversight, not just by American, but by international organizations such as the IAEA. Well, that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And do stay tuned next week when we come back with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.